You're listening to Radio Freethinker, episode 70.
There is unrest in the forest, there is trouble with the trees, for the maples want more sunlight and the oaks ignore their pleas.
Welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is Rob, cognitive psychologist and world traveler.
And this is Daniel, who's not here because he got a job.
Well said, Daniel.
I heard actually he was abducted by aliens. And if Quarksig, you're out there, we've assembled almost everything, but I don't think they make a purple tang. But please don't send us any more of his fingers. We believe you. You have him.
But we may have said too much.
Well, getting back to reality, look who's back. It's Dawn and Rob, the people
Hello.
Who disappeared Hello. For like 3 weeks.
Yes.
Only two.
But I was here in spirit a few times, so you hoped you...
I'm skeptical of that.
Yes. Actually, you know, I had a really bizarre time in a way. I went back and I visited my birth town, Brandon, Manitoba. Great time there. But actually, I got into a bit of a controversy while I was there. You may or may not know that the Queen has visited Canada this past week. And one of our local MPs gave away his ticket to go see the Queen to someone because apparently they knew how to toast the Queen. And apparently, according to the news article that I read, you're not supposed to use wine to toast the Queen.
It figures I go to England and the Queen comes here.
Well, being the skeptic that I am, I said, you know, this didn't sound right. So me and my research team, I have a research team, looked into this, and it didn't quite suss. So I sent a letter to the editor saying, listen, hey, this didn't sound right, and maybe this person who happened to be a wealthy member of town, whatever, right? So I sent the letter off to the editor, and they didn't publish my letter, but in the next week's editorial, yeah, it's every week they seem to have an editorial, they comment about my letter saying, hey, this guy, what does he know? Yeah, they just ripped me a new one, which was really unfair because they didn't actually publish my original criticism, which was very good and very skeptical. But
did they put it online somewhere?
They didn't put my original letter to the editor at all, but they made reference to it in the editorial criticizing it.
So they just started criticizing you out of nowhere.
Essentially, yeah. You know, they said, hey, we got this letter, and boy, if you had read it, let me tell you what you would have thought about it. You can't read it, because we don't want you to actually know what he said, because, well, obviously a little biased. I thought it was very salient and cogent, and I made a good damn argument.
You should send them a letter in response.
Yes.
And then they can criticize it without publishing it.
Well, that's one of the weird things. I mean, and it's hard for me to buy into this, but it's a small town, and you know, the article I originally was like a little fluff PR piece, right? And at first I was, this is horrible. But then, of course, talking to other people in Brandon, they said, well, no, this is what you get with small little local newspapers. They don't actually do journalism anymore. They just do, wouldn't your garden be nice with gnomes this season kind of things. So I felt very big city in a small town the last 2 weeks. But I had a lot of fun, and thanks to my parents for making a wonderful trip.
Wow. Rob, you were off in the UK.
I've been gone for 2 weeks. I spend a lot of time in London, basically dealing with bureaucrats for most of it. I had meetings with
a lot of the admissions department and housing departments at University College London, where I'm going to study at the end of this year, trying to hash out a variety of details involving, you know, how much I'm going to pay them and where I'm going to live, and they seem reticent at providing the necessary details. I also tried to open a bank account with HSBC, which you'd think would be easy considering that I already have an HSBC bank account here, and they allow people to extend their accounts to open them up in other countries so long as they have an HSBC account here. So I went there, and apparently they have completely different rules in London about how documents and bureaucracy have to work. So that's apparently still in progress, and they have to call the branch here, and I hate bureaucracy. But I did talk with a lot of academics, and it looks like I'm going to have a good time studying there. Part of the more interesting part of the trip was the time I spent in Poland visiting my brother, who I haven't actually seen in quite a lot of time. He's been there studying in med school for 4 years now, maybe 3 or 4 years, and I really only see him once a year for a couple of days around Christmas time. So spending a lot of time with him was interesting because he does so many things now that he didn't used to. Among them, he smokes like a chimney. Like, he's a pack-a-day smoker now, and that was really, like, this is something that happens all the time in Poland. I think the air quality there is roughly 40% industrial toxic fumes, 40% cigarette smoke, and the rest is actual air. And he also wears glasses now, which is weird. He plays the piano. I never thought
he
would. Weird. Super weird. I mean, that's probably the weirdest thing of all.
Well, he's from Poland, so he can't play well.
Actually, Chopin is from Poland, and it's, I think, 200th anniversary of his birthday or something right now. And I visited Warsaw. I was there where he was born and did a lot of his work. And Chopin is everywhere. They're opening up a new Chopin museum. When you're wandering around, there's these little benches that you can sit on. And when you sit on them, they start playing Chopin music from speakers hidden underneath the bench. And it's like, what the?
That sounds expensive and weird.
Yeah, it was a little weird. But the weirdest thing of all that my brother does now that he didn't do before is go to church regularly.
Uh-oh.
And, I mean, I thought it was like, so what? You're going to church now? Because he used to be a really, really staunch atheist. He actually hated going to church. I was raised, you know, Polish Catholic. We used to go to church. He absolutely hated it, refused it, complained, kicked and screamed, and was as staunch an atheist as he could be. Now 3 years since I've seen him, and he goes to church regularly in Poland and was telling me about how, you know, there has to be a God. There has to be a reason for everything. And I just thought it was interesting about this sort of role reversal. And I got to thinking about, like, why this would have happened and thinking about, well, it's such a incredibly huge fact of life in Poland that the church has its greedy tentacles in everything, basically. It's involved at the highest levels of politics. It's involved in daily life in Poland. And I was wondering, like, well, maybe that's why. I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. We'll have to have him on the show at some point to explain himself.
Yes. I wanted to get him to do an interview, and he was like, no, no, no.
You don't think so. This is a bit crass, but if everyone in Poland, or a lot of people in Poland, are religious, and he's going to be a doctor, you said, right?
Yep.
So maybe for his practice, people would feel more comfortable if they knew he went to church. It's a PR thing.
It could be. I mean, bedside manner is important to, you know, dealing with patients and helping them get better. But he was also, I mean, he's doing rotations. He sees a lot of people dying. Possibly that is going to throw you for a loop and you start looking for meaning.
I'm quite sure he thanks God every time he sees someone dying.
Well, speaking of travel, I'm actually going to be doing some traveling very soon. In fact, I'm heading down to TAM tomorrow. Now, what is TAM, you might ask? Well, it's actually the amazing meeting sponsored by the JREF every year in Las Vegas. It's the biggest skeptical gathering of atheists, agnostics, humanists, skeptics, scientists, and generally nerds. And we get together, you drink a lot, you correspond a lot, you listen to talks, you go to workshops, you come back and you go, wow, that was pretty awesome.
So this is where a bunch of you get together, you express fellowship, you do certain rituals that are customary amongst your kind,
and then you
go out and you spread the word that you have gained at this. So this is, it sounds very religious to me.
Yeah, it is kind of like a revival in many regards. In fact, that's something that when Jeff Wegg was a guest on Radio Freethinker, we sort of talked about, and you can find that episode in our archives. But more importantly than that, however, we're going to have the opportunity to talk to some really cool people, and I want to spill the beans a bit on some of the people we're going to be talking to. And if you listeners out there want us to ask questions or, you know, bring up a certain topic that you're just dying to know about it.
Or pry about any personal details.
Yeah, pry into these people's personal lives. Remember to email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We're going to be talking with Jennifer Michael Hecht, Michael Shermer, Rachel Dunup, and Joe Nickel.
Okay, so I know some of those. I know Richard Dawkins. I know Shermer. Who are these other people? I'm sorry to be stupid, but who are these people again?
He is playing Simplico to I can't remember my Play-Doh. Never mind.
Okay. Well,
you're playing your Simplico to yourself. You don't know who it's from.
Yeah, well, anyway, so we're going to be talking with a lot of skeptics, scientists, various practitioners of magic, of performance artists. We're going to be talking with investigators. Joe Nickel is quite prominent from his articles in Skeptical Inquirer, investigating all manner of pseudoscience and whatnot. So a great opportunity to talk to some people who have been in the industry or industry of skepticism for a very long time, and I encourage you to write in with your questions and comments.
And we'll put the list of those names up on our blog so that you can do a little research and find out what sort of questions you want to ask about them.
Exactly. Well, before we go on, let's take a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker and be back with some more after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're going to be talking a bit about the oil spill and BP. I'm sure that if you haven't been living under a rock recently, you've probably heard about this. One solution that's being tossed about is nuclear.
As in they should take the headquarters of BP and nuke it. No.
I actually saw a lot of BP stations while I was on traveling, and it was really weird because there was nobody using them.
You know, actually, I was watching CNN while I was visiting, and they had a thing about poor BP employees in the gas station saying, you know, I know you hate BP, but this is my job. I had nothing to do with it. But the inkling of this is the idea of trying to blow up the well. The idea, apparently, was suggested by a guy named Christopher Brownfield, who was a one-time nuclear submarine officer, a volunteer in Iraq War, and is currently a nuclear policy researcher at Columbia University.
Isn't the well blowing up what started the problem in the first place?
Well, yes and no. The principle behind this is, well, the explosion happened above the well. So the well, the actual hole in the earth, it happened above in the 4 or 5 miles, however high up it is, from the floor of the ocean to the top of the sea.
It's
pretty
deep.
That's where it cracked off. The idea of this is to actually seal the well in the ground. So you're it's like kind of like putting a Band-Aid on it and then taking a hot iron and searing the Band-Aid on.
With a nuke.
with a nuke. Yeah, actually, what was it? In an article in the New York Times, actually, Brownfield just said we should blow it up. But it was another guy named William Broad in the New York Times who said, hey, we should nuke it. And actually, former President Bill Clinton sort of supported the idea of blowing up the well as late as June 29th. And the government official, and I wish I could remember his name, Tommy something, he's got some weird first name, who's the government official there, who says, you know, they're planning to drill relief wells. A relief well is where they drill a parallel well to the original broken well, and then they sort of tap into it at the bottom, and the oil and gas or whatever is supposed to go out the secondary well, and that they can control. But they're not sure now that's even going to work. They knew it was going to work. It was just going to take time up until now, and now they're about 2 weeks away from it actually trying it, and now they're saying, well, this might not work either. And judging from their previous success, a lot of people think it doesn't work.
So is this just completely pie in the sky? I mean, a nuke seems rather a hard way to, you know, long shot.
Well,
you know,
in a very colorful article, emphasis on the word colorful, in Scientific America, where they went into great explanation about the sound of the voice of former Soviet minister and how it, you could hear it crackle with its many years of smoking. It must have been in Poland for a few number of years there. But apparently the Soviet Union, they've been using nukes left, right, and center for non-military actions. They had a policy called nuclear explosions for the national economy, which started in 1958. And they've exploded up to 124 nuclear bombs for doing things like digging canals, creating underground storage, disposing of toxic waste, and sealing gas leaks. They stopped it actually when the Soviet Union more or less stopped in 1989 was when they stopped doing this. So the Soviet Union has used five times to try and seal off runaway gas pipeline gas wells, and it's worked three or four times. They use the word three or four times because one of those times it worked for a while. But then it didn't work. And one of the reasons why it didn't work is the nuclear bomb was actually close to a city. And for some reason they thought, well, maybe we shouldn't make it a big bomb. We should make it a small bomb so we don't actually wipe out the city, too. See, the Soviet Union, they cared about the people. But because they used such a small bomb, it didn't actually work to seal it. But they've what was it? In Uzbekistan, there's a place in Uzbekistan. In 1966, they sealed off a lake. It's the first time they used nuclear bombs for that. And the last time they used it was in Kharkov in the Ukraine in 1977.
So what about the environmental effects of nuking water?
Well, first of all, the type of nuke that this guy suggested using was only a 30-kiloton bomb, which is about three times the size, apparently, they used in Nagasaki. Although I remember it being bigger, but he said 30 kilotons, about that. And it's only going to cost about $10 million if they did it. And considering they spent over $2 billion so far in the cleanup and that, it seems economically. But you're right. There are some issues. Fallout, right? Well, the fallout actually isn't an issue here because it's underwater. And that actually, the pressure and all that will actually contain any of the evil nuclear stuff there. And it's a small enough low yield that it wouldn't be a big issue even if it was on land, although there would be some issues, which is one of the reasons why the Soviet Union were using nukes left, right, and center, and the United States were going to as well, but they said, well, no, this fallout thing on land is probably not, even low levels, probably not a good deal. So the idea that there will be fallout is sort of a harm reduction. So there will be fallout. There'll be a few more radiation cancer cases of fish in the area.
I suppose it won't be as bad as the, you know, guts and lungs being choked by the oil that's already there.
Right. Now, another problem is it's actually kind of not tested. Now, you say, wait a minute, you just talked about how the Soviet Union used it left, right, and center. And the Soviet Union did it. But every time they used it on land. And they used it to do gas leaks, not oil leaks. So although it's hard to think that there would be a significant difference, this is, like I say, about 4 or 5 kilometers under the ocean, and it is an oil deposit, which the mechanics of it are slightly different, so there's that issue. But the biggest problem with this, and I'm sure there are geologists out there who will know the answer to this, and you can email us at radio.freethinker.gmail.com. See, this is why I never say the email. Anyhow. Is the actual geological formation. So you let a nuclear bomb go, and it will make basically a glass plug over the hole itself. Great. But the shock waves are going to go through the Earth. And there's one worry that these shock waves will actually crack the ground, the bedrock, and actually create more fissures where the oil will leak out. Which is why this is sort of like, we don't want to do this first, because there are a lot of potentials. But the other alternative is having this go for who knows how long, releasing. I heard this morning that oil's been now found on the Texas coast. So officially, it's hit all the Gulf Coast states. On NPR, I believe, their Science Friday, they were talking about how the oil has a good chance of getting into the Gulf Stream, which means it could then spread to the entire east coast of the United States. Although apparently the Maritimes will be safe, so really we don't care. So I don't know. I thought, nuke, why not? I mean, they're a horrible thing, sure, in war, but we've got them. Why not try and use them for good things? Thoughts?
Well, you kind of covered everything there, so no. I guess it's kind of wrapping your head around using a nuke on something like an oil spill is just sort of like, I don't know, kind of excessive.
Well,
like,
you know,
using a tank to like run over a mosquito.
Does it have to be a nuke, or can it, is, does it have to be that powerful in order to glass over the leak?
Well, I guess this is the problem, is to get like something like 30 kilotons down there of conventional weapons would in itself have much greater chance of failure, just because it'd be a much larger task. But as I said, when this was originally proposed, it was originally proposed as conventional weapons. The guy said he toyed with the idea of nuclear weapons, but ultimately said it probably wouldn't be politically acceptable and that type of thing. So I would not rule out using conventional weapons. Although I think the environmentalists, at least some of them, would love this, because here again we have a green energy source defeating a carbon-producing energy source, where you have, you know, nuclear power defeats the...
I don't know. A lot of environmentalists are not exactly happy with nuclear power.
Yes. Well, okay.
All right. Well, Rob, you were telling me an interesting story about the current state of UFO... ology in Europe.
Yeah, on the subject of Daniel being abducted by aliens, actually. This morning I was reading some stories from the Associated Press, and a European Union member of parliament named Mario Borghizio, he's the Italian MP in the EU, he wrote an open letter and sent it an email to the Associated Press calling for more transparency and oversight in the EU about UFOlogy.
Is this a big problem, the EU covering up UFO?
According to Mario, yes, it is. He says that they should stop the systematic cover-up of military and public sightings of UFOs, and that the EU should have its own sort of X-Files where they... keep track of files about UFO sightings.
Actually, I think Project Blue Book, because that was the official government investigation into UFOs. X-Files was a fictional account of a guy in some FBI.
It's important to keep these straight.
But, you know, I'm going to play slightly devil's advocate here, because although I think it infinitesimally unlikely that UFOs have actually visited Earth, and if they did, I doubt they'd keep it a secret. But the term UFO just means unidentified flying object. So it is potential that there are military experiments going on that they're trying to cover up. That maybe is it possible this guy is just using UFOlogy as an attempt to try and pry loose some government secrets in the military of Europe, or is he just a nut?
Based on the quotes from the letter in the Associated Press and also the Globe and Mail cover this, he wasn't writing it like some kind of UFO nut. Aside from the systematic cover-up quote, it does basically seem like he is assuming that they are, in fact, just unidentified flying objects, not aliens, to the point of suggesting that there should be an established scientific research center for UFOs where you could get major scientific and technological spin-offs. That's a direct quote from the letter that he wrote, that scientists should study these sightings rather than them being just filed away in a drawer somewhere and only ever leaked out every once in a while or uncovered by a request for the Freedom of Information Act. And in order for this to get to the EU vote, he needs to get a large number of signatures. There's 736 members in the EU Parliament. So far, he's only got 18 signatures.
Interesting. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but did not the UK very recently adopt a very similar program?
Yeah, just last year, actually.
And didn't the United States also have a program that was eventually canceled because it was just a huge waste of taxpayer money?
Mm-hmm. And the UK program, I think, was either called to be shut down or actually was shut down just because all that it ever did was occasionally release some information through a, you know, information freedom of information request. I think this situation is a little different, specifically because of the call for actual investigation of the claims, the establishment of a scientific research center that would look into them, learn what it can, you know, possibly just confirming what it already knows about weather balloons and swamp gas, but possibly learning something new about, you know, how light behaves in the atmosphere or what have you, that could eventually be exploited in the realm of science and technology. But at the same time, you know, the UK, the US both have these agencies. Presumably they do have some military scientists that were looking into it. Nothing's been made public about any advances that might have been made from it. And if it is, like Don suggested, military testing, then maybe they don't want to make the information public. But, you know?
Well, that would actually, no. See, that would, his comment there blows my idea, because then we'd already know the scientific spin-offs. It might be hidden, but, I mean, the scientists already, there's no science, you don't scientifically investigate other scientists to find out what discoveries they made. That's called, well, not plagiarism, but there's a...
Espionage.
That's the word I'm thinking.
Did you guys hear about the Russian spy? Not to change the subject.
Yeah, no, the spies are good.
Well, why don't we take a commercial break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Free Thinker.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
Radio.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio. Yep. Happy.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
And that's all we're going to be doing with aliens for now.
You know, Ethan, guys, you know, I was over the weekend, I got some great news. We made a difference. Now you might be thinking that I might have an overinflated ego for the show, but no.
Don, no.
I am absolutely convinced that this show changed the world. I was watching reports on it, and actually watched the Toronto Pride Parade in Toronto that happened this weekend. And lo and behold, one of the floats that were in there was won by QA, Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. Apparently, the Toronto Pride Committee reversed its original decision to ban the group from being on there and said, listen, we believe in free speech, and face it, it seems insane to quash the entire Pride Parade because one person didn't like something about the float itself. So this show, which if you remember in our episode, spearheaded a movement to try and bring Qua's ability to say its thing. Well, it worked. We did it. Come on, guys.
High five.
We are the champ.
Well, that's good. Are you sure it was us?
Well, you know, I choose to believe that until something else comes forward. Although, of course, it was interesting to note that there was one, what I would call an ultra-Zionist group, who came out with a homophobic neo-right-wing group to say, well, listen, you guys did this, and boy, you're going to pay, and tried to retroactively get the funding for Pride Parade withdrawn. But it seems like the grassroots movement, the youth movement, the free speech movement, all that, rallied around the Pride Parade and said, we're going to support you and you guys should do this. And they did the right thing. It's occasionally goodness defeats evil.
Mm, excellent. We could also note that CFI sponsored another float in that same parade, the Atheist Pride Parade.
Exactly. Yeah. Definitely a good opportunity to reach out to people who might be skeptics but don't know it yet. Well, let's shift gears again. I have some interesting news for you guys. Are you aware that Stanley Park might not be known as Stanley Park?
Well, I heard actually that they were going to rename our show too.
Really?
Well, apparently there's this wave going on that they're renaming things.
Interesting.
Actually, I had heard that they're going to call it XXY something.
Yeah, it was a Haida name, I think.
It's a Coast Salish name.
Coast Salish.
Well, let me give you the background in case you haven't heard about this. A 95-year-old elder from the Squamish First Nation suggested a name change to Stanley Park to reflect its Aboriginal history. About 100 years ago, there was a village called Quay Quay, but it's spelled X-W-A-Y-X-W-A-Y. Located sort of the northern area of the park, you know, where Lumberman's Arch is now. And they figured, okay, well, you know, it's got this Aboriginal history. Let's, you know, reflect that in the name of the park. Well, this kind of idea actually caught on and got a lot of attention. People were either for it or against it, but it got a lot of play. In fact, the BC Tourism Minister, Kevin Kruger, immediately endorsed the idea of putting an Aboriginal name alongside the current one. To go along with that, Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson also added his support to this idea. And the Squamish First Nation leader to originally, well not originally, but has since taken this issue and ran with it, Ian Campbell, has said that he thinks this is, you know, a fantastic idea and is actually seeking the formal process to get the name changed. And then another interesting aspect to this is that not only did the BC Minister of Tourism, but also a private organization, Tourism Vancouver, their president, Rick Antonson, said that he's also in favor of the idea and actually said this would be a really huge benefit to tourism here in Vancouver. So the idea is that Stanley Park would not stop being Stanley Park. You would just sort of add, like, Quay Quay to it. So it might be called Quay Quay Stanley Park from now on.
Well, I remember on the way up to Whistler that for the Olympic Games, I think, they put the native name of Squamish up in signs all over there. And there's this big rock that has, you know, welcome to Squamish. And then it has the actual orthography of the native word as well.
Exactly. Now, this is relating to some other interesting changes to BC's landmarks. Perhaps you've heard that Haida Gwaia, which is the new name for the Queen Charlotte Islands, which is reflecting its Haida origin. Obviously, the Haida were there before Queen Charlotte was, if she ever was. And the Salish Sea has replaced the combined name for the Strait of Georgia, the Puget Sound, and the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So you might ask yourself, well why? Why on earth would we change the names of any of these places? Now, maybe on the surface it seems kind of pointless. In theory, it's not the name, but the location that matters. You know, the old phrase or quote, a rose bearing another name would smell as sweet, right? It doesn't really matter what you call something. If you have an emotional attachment to it, that's what matters. But of course, by that logic, there's no reason not to change the name, because then who cares what the name is? You might as well call it, you know, like Cell Phone Park or something, or, you know, Dog Park or some other ridiculous name. So
tell us, you know, park,
Radio Free Thinker Park.
That I like that one actually. Yes. That's a good one. So there's a lot of emotion involved in this debate, and I think as skeptics we have to be cautious lest we start making arguments based on appeals to emotion or some other logical fallacy. But there are several points here that I think we can actually skeptically analyze and, you know, keep it within the realm of critical thinking. Now, one concrete aspect is tourism. That's pretty concrete. Another aspect is historic fact, also quite concrete. And the third part, which is, I admit, gets a little bit fuzzy, but still I think kind of concrete, is cultural impact and importance. Now, what we really can't skeptically analyze is multiculturalism, inclusiveness, or the value of reparations. I mean, you can't really say to someone, you know, you feel included. No, I don't. Well, how are you going to test that?
Well, okay, so if we can't do that, How would this affect tourism? I mean, we had the Olympic Games, and that was supposed to be our money shot for that. But tourism, I mean,
right?
People couldn't even pronounce it properly. I mean, I'd look at that, and I wanted to go Xerxes or something.
Xerxes? Okay.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Well, the notion behind tourism is that Stanley Park's value to the city is that it brings in a lot of tourists. It's not only locally, it's a well-known city artifact, but it's also known internationally as one of the most beautiful parks in Canada. So the issue here is, what is going to hurt or benefit tourism? Now, the fact that two very influential and probably, you know, let's assume, specialists in tourism, the BC Minister of Tourism and the President of Tourism Vancouver, both endorse the idea and think it would actually be a huge benefit, indicates that, well, chances are it probably would be a huge benefit, and that adding native language and terminology to the park would increase its tourism value.
Doesn't this run the risk of, and I don't know what the politically correct term, but native washing it? I mean, it's Stanley Park. It has been for at least 100 years a European style park. It has been run by white men for that long. And although we might want to, for tourism reasons, want to say, okay, we're going to call it Queequeg. Thank you, Queequeg. Somehow that, doesn't it kind of ring as a little
very hollow?
Yes.
And not like the hollow tree that also, for tourist reasons, it was starting to rot and fall apart. It was struck by lightning and in the windstorms. It was nearly completely toppled. So they started shoring it up with metal struts and supports inside just because tourists were coming to see it. Never mind that the tree was, you know, completely decrepit.
Although, you know, I could see a tourist group selling this. They say, listen, when you come to Vancouver, we'll send you to two great historical parks. We'll send you first on an all-expense-paid tour of Stanley Park. And once you're done that, we'll send you on another tour of
Queequeg.
I don't know why I pronounce that.
It's a hard name to say.
On Queequeg.
But fun.
Right? So it's like, you get two for the price of one. And little do they realize that, no, they get one for the price of one.
One for the price of two.
Well, I mean, there is a certain level of pure capitalist interest in this. If you're talking about purely maximizing Stanley Park's output, adding Queequeg apparently seems to be a good idea. Now, maybe that's kind of callous and cold, but there you have it. I think that's pretty well established by the sort of tourism aspect. Now, the other aspect is historic fact. And this, again, is pretty darn concrete. The historic record is pretty clear that the location of Stanley Park was once home to the Coast Salish people. Now, what that means, of course, is that the Coast Salish people are not one uniform people. That makes up hundreds, if not thousands, of different tribes. So the area of Stanley Park did not just belong to one uniform group of people. However, if we want to base our decisions on who it belongs to, which, let's face it, is sort of one of the ways we determine who owns land, not that it's a good way or anything, then the Coast Salish people have a far longer claim to it than Canadians or European colonials. You know, we're talking about 200 years of Canadian/English history versus thousands of years of Native history. It's right there in the history books.
But now here's another complicating fact, is that, well, we know for the last 100, 200 years it's been Stanley Park, but because there's no written record and only an oral history, it might have actually only been called that name for 50 years beforehand. Okay, probably longer than 50 years. But I mean, one of the things that we had, and I think we talked about this long before, about how the First Nations may not actually have been the First Nations. There may have been the Clovis people beforehand who were not actually Native, and there are other migrations. Yeah. So the point being, though, is that there may have been previous occupations of that where it was a different people, and so this claim of it's been there forever.
Yeah.
And we talked about it too when we talked about Israel a few shows ago, about the Golan Heights, which apparently weren't the Golan Heights prior to 1967. They were the Syrian Heights, and they were the Syrian Heights forever. But that somehow doesn't, it's in the mix, but not.
Right. Like I say, it's not a good way of determining who, quote unquote, owns the land, but it's one of the most common ways of doing it. And it's, I think, along the same lines as a lot of the arguments that are being made right now in the media about Stanley Park is, well, who was there first? Who's had it the longest? That sort of thing. And you're sort of right. We don't know for sure who was there, how long they were there. One way that we can investigate this is through archaeological and anthropological evidence that is relatively established, that's, you know, pretty reputable in terms of scientifically speaking, and does seem to indicate that the Coast Salish people were there for a very long time, longer than, again, the Canadian or English colonials. Now, the other aspect to this, and I do admit this does get a little fuzzy, but cultural impact or importance. Now, if we're going by a pure numbers game, where we want the most people possible to feel a cultural connection with Stanley Park, then adding Queequeg to the name is a huge net gain. Because presumably, nobody is going to lose connection to Stanley Park if you add Queequeg. but a whole group of people stand to gain connection to it by adding Kwe Kwe.
It seems a little simplistic. I think
it is simplistic, and it is kind of callous as well. But it, in terms of just making it appeal to more people than incorporating Aboriginal names or terminology, doesn't take away from people who crave that connection to a former Governor General of Canada. But well, it does add a little connection to people who may not normally feel a connection to it.
People might lose a connection to the park because of the rigmarole over changing its name. They might be sort of like, well, I mean, why are you going to change its name? It seems silly. It doesn't matter in the end, as we were saying before. So people will sort of start to associate Stanley Park with this sort of, you know, like we were saying, the native washing or with an attempt to just boost tourism numbers and a whole bunch of people might actually lose a connection with Stanley Park.
And actually, to bring a parallel into, I mean, India recently went through a big name change, right, where a bunch of their cities were changed from their British name to their pre-British name. Or supposedly, there's been debate whether those were really the names beforehand, but let's assume that that's all true. Mm-hmm. Isn't it actually also possible, because it's going to have this dual name, that if I happen to be a good old monarchist imperial, and I love our imperial history, and it's a great history, I'm proud to be Canadian, and every time I hear Quake Quake Stanley Park, I go, oh, goddamn, in some derogatory term. Mm-hmm. Conversely, if I'm a native individual, and I sit there and it says, and they have Quake Quake Stanley Park, oh, bloody white, some other derogatory term. So really, because you've got these two names, you're just reminding the other side of whatever antagonisms that may exist in society as it goes.
Potentially, you could do that. I think, though, that if you have racist leanings either way, you're probably not going to be very satisfied.
Well, this doesn't
regardless.
Have to be racist. It doesn't have to be. I tried to, because this is a radio show, and we need to razzle dazzle. I do a tap show, but you can't
see
it. But I mean, it's not even, it doesn't have to be racist. I mean, obviously, there's a number of people in the Aboriginal community who feel somewhat slighted by British occupation, and there are a number of people in the quote unquote white population, although that's now extended. If you happen to be from Asia, you know, be it India or China or whatever, and you like the name Stanley Park, then you say, well, why do I have to suddenly have this new name for this other group who I don't know, they, you know, I mean, it doesn't have to be racist, mm-hmm. but it can be the idea of political correctness can sometimes rub people the wrong way just because it's, I don't like change, or this reminds me of change, however you go. So you're saying if we have both names, everyone's going to be happy, and I'm saying that might actually just remind people that there's actually this tension that doesn't normally surface.
True enough. I was kind of discounting the people who are, you know, phobic of change, because those people tend not to be very skeptical or rational speaking.
That's the sort of thing where if you've got a problem with things like this or an entire group of people or whatever, you're going to find pretty much any reason to be annoyed with this sort of thing. What's going to happen.
Yeah, like if you're that annoyed, then like you might want to take out the totem poles out of Stanley Park or something, and or, you know, go even further and rename it something even more British, like Elizabeth II Park.
Or maybe you call it Green Park.
Green Park.
Peninsular Park.
Sure.
Well, to bring it to a slightly different part of downtown, I just found out this morning, I think I was reading the Beyond Robson blog, but the Vancouver Canucks contract with GM is going to run out, and they're probably going to be sponsored by Rogers. So GM Place might be renamed Rogers Place, just because of who owns it. Mm-hmm. And with that kind of name change, I mean, people have been lovingly calling GM Place the Garage for as long as anyone can remember, because it's GM Place. And really, even if it changes to Rogers Place, people might keep calling it the Garage just because that's what they've always called it. So I think what might happen is that a lot of people will just keep calling it Stanley Park because it's sort of automatic. You know, you see it and you go, oh yeah, the Stanley Park. It doesn't matter what the official name is. All that really matters is what people actually end up calling it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I want to give you guys an update on the current situation with Stanley Park. The name is not going to change. Stockwell Day, the minister for the Pacific Gateway, and the minister of Canadian Heritage, James Moore, issued a joint press statement to the effect that the name is not going to change.
What? Sorry. So the Conservative government's against it?
Surprisingly, yes.
Oh, well, sorry, then I think we should change this. I think that would be wonderful.
So the general argument, well, not even argument, the general statement that they said basically goes along these lines. That the general point is the name of Stanley Park is known to Canadians as Stanley Park. Apparently, adding the words Kwe Kwe might make Canadians forget where it is or something.
What?
That's me adding an editorial. I'll stop doing that now.
Okay.
They also cited how it's internationally known as Stanley Park. I guess the implication being that tourism might suffer, which, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't seem to be the case. Nevertheless, tradition and heritage have also been mentioned, and I want to read you a quote from their statement. Like many places in Canada, Stanley Park has a history that has evolved over many thousands of years and has been home to many of Canada's peoples, including the members of the Squamish First Nation. At the same time, like many places in Canada, Stanley Park now has an established name, which has held for over a century. I notice a sort of dichotomy here between mentioning thousands of years of Native history, but a colonial name that's been around for like 200 years, so come on. If you're going to mention one aspect of time as a factor here and then ignore thousands of years of history, I think that's kind of a false dichotomy.
No, I think cognitive dissonance, the ability to hold two contradictory ideas. And so the reason why we're calling it Stanley Park because it's long historical ties with that name. And yes, it also has thousands of years with the native name, but that's not it's important. No, it's not. It is. No, it's, yeah. Doesn't Stockwell's day's head then explode?
Yeah.
No, actually, here's another thing. How come they haven't thought of putting one of those little parks? And I remember when I was a kid going to historical recreations of something. So it'd still be Stanley Park. So those who the minister would be happy.
But they'd have Kwek Kwek.
You'd have in a Kwek Kwek village.
Well, I think
would be an homage to the original inhabitants.
I actually think that's one of the ideas that was sort of floating around because, like we said, Kwek Kwek, the village that we're referring to here, didn't occupy all of Stanley Park. I mean, it's a huge park, obviously. It occupied a very small portion. So they might actually have, as a compromise, Kwek Kwek Park, Kwek Kwek Village in Stanley Park. Which I think is kind of an interesting idea because it is a historic aspect of the park. And getting back to sort of something that we kind of mentioned before, and that is sort of the cultural heritage, how a lot of Canadians feel cultural heritage towards Great Britain, even though it's not Great Britain anymore. Now, the question I have here is, how does it make you more Canadian to embrace the culture of another nation? Specifically because the driving force behind, you know, let's embrace Great Britain is a rejection of American culture.
Well, it's interesting. It's a big discussion here about what Canadian national identity is. And I remember even in like high school in social studies class, sort of ending up deciding that Canadian national identity was basically a combination on one hand of being made up of a lot of different nations, and on the other, we're not the United States.
Actually, you know, it's funny you bring that up, and actually this is probably a whole segment sometime. But one of the things that's always bugged me growing up is that I'm classified as European, but my family, at least part of my family, is at least seven generations lived here. And actually it probably goes back further than that, and we've just lost track of it. So I consider myself to be native Canadian because I've been here for such a very long time that I think that qualifies. And your comment pulls right into that. And I think that's one of the things that we have trouble with is to say I'm Canadian because we have a multicultural society that the term Canadian often doesn't mean, oh, you're Canadian, you're from here. It's you're Canadian because you live here, but you're from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, it's sort of like the notion that something that is quintessentially Canadian, like Stanley Park, the point being, though, that Stanley, Mr. Stanley, Lord Stanley, whatever his name, first name was.
Was a Canadian governor general.
He was
Canadian Governor General.
A British politician who governed Canada. It's, again, this...
Next thing you're going to say, the Stanley Cup was from a British politician.
It kind of was. But the point being here is we're expressing our nationalism by appealing to nationalism of another country. And if we're going to... I have mixed feelings about nationalism in the first place, but if we're going to appeal to nationalism, I think we need to establish what Canadian nationalism actually is.
Good luck.
Well, that's maybe our listeners have an opinion on that.
Yeah, if you have an opinion on the possible renaming of Stanley Park as Queequeg, or of the establishment of a little reenactment village in it, or about Canadian national identity and Lord Stanley, please write in to radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Well, at least tell me the Grey Cup, Lord Grey, that he was Canadian.
What do you want to hear?
I don't know anymore.
Well, speaking of not this topic.
So not speaking of this topic.
Exactly. We've had some pretty interesting events recently. If you've been away like Rob or Don here, but if you were here, you noticed that we had Lawrence Krauss here in Vancouver.
Yeah, how was that?
It was actually quite good. I'm biased because I organized it, but I found it really fascinating. Lawrence Krauss came here. He gave a talk for about 300 people. We had a book signing. We had a Q&A at the end. Then we had a reception here at UBC. Everybody seemed to enjoy themselves. It was a very fascinating talk. And Professor Krauss did a really good job of, I think, explaining some very complex physics and astronomy stuff, kind of toning it down, I get, for the general audience who maybe doesn't have that background of science. And it was just a very fascinating talk, and I hope people who went to it enjoyed it. And, well, I guess you guys couldn't have gone. But
Will there be video?
We did record it. Hopefully it will go up on our YouTube channel very soon.
Perfect.
So because I wasn't there, I need to know. Does the universe exist or not?
It exists, but that's all we know.
What was the sort of two-sentence gist of the story?
Well, the talk was called A Universe from Nothing. Now, the implication being is that we do not need a divine creator to create the universe. But it was also a lot about what's going to happen to the universe. What's the future of the universe going to be like? And one very interesting aspect of this was that as the universe ages, we are going to get stupider. Because galaxies are going to move farther and farther apart to the point where we will no longer be able to see them. So we will only be able to see things in our own galaxy. So we are actually going to have mistaken views of the universe because we can't see the rest of the universe. So at some point in the future, we are going to have mistaken understandings of physics and science, even though the universe is out there, we just won't be able to observe it.
What? So you're saying that in the future, we can look forward to the laws of physics behaving differently in our neighborhood than in other parts of the universe?
Well, they won't behave differently, we just won't be able to observe them behaving differently.
Assuming that we won't find some way of moving between different spaces in the universe.
I guess.
Well, and let's not forget the pan-dimensional invasion that's scheduled for Thursday at 3 o'clock next week.
Fortunately, I'll be at TAM at that, so won't bother me. Well, on the subject of events coming up, we have some pretty interesting skeptical highlights, including on July 30th, CFI is presenting a talk by the one and only P.Z. Myers entitled Atheism in the Scientific Battleground. That's going to be here at UBC in the Westbrook Building at 7 p.m. And tickets can be ordered online at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver.
And you can find P.Z. Myers blogging online at the highly popular Pharyngula blog.
And he actually did mention his upcoming trip to Vancouver in that said blog.
Did he mention our show?
No. But we might be able to get him on the show.
Ooh, that'd be cool.
Fun. Yes. Well, any other skeptical highlights?
I don't have a skeptical highlight, but since we have a few minutes left in the show, I was remembering the episode we had a little while ago when I wasn't here to ably talk about this, but we did have Ethan and company to talk about organic pesticides.
That's right.
And one of the takeaway things from that, which I thought was a little misrepresentative, but maybe it was the way I heard the show, was that organic pesticides are always worse than non-organic pesticides, which I don't think you guys meant to say, but that's how it came across in the episode, that although organic pesticides may be good, they may be bad, sometimes they're not. And that led me into an interesting article that I had read about organic pests.
Organic pests.
Well, the headline, and again, this is from Scientific
Pests
America.
Organic?
Yeah, this is Scientific America, so don't bitch at me. it says, organic farms win at potato pest control. Now, what do you think that title would imply about the article?
that organic farms are better at controlling pests that destroy potato crops?
That's what I thought. And like I say, I was thinking about this episode and I was saying, you know, maybe I should try and bring a little extra balance to whatever, right? So then I read into it and I was dumbstruck. Because apparently what it says is that organic farms have a relative abundance of different species of pests. So it's not that they have fewer pests, although apparently they have a few less pests than the normal ones do. But what they have is they have a great diversity of pests. Whereas in non-organic farms, you get rid of almost all of them, but one or two species just proliferate and you get a whole bunch of them. But how does this mean that organic farms win? It just says that they've got a greater biodiversity, which, as we all know, biodiversity helps the pests win. So it was a bizarre thing. And then when it come right down to it, they said, well, you know, we're not really saying whether organic farming is better than not. This was just about the biodiversity of pests and pest control. And then they said, oh, yeah, and by the way, they grow bigger potato crops, bigger potatoes, which I guess apparently means you get more potato per plant, even if you only get half as many plants. But
well, they're all eaten by pests.
Yeah, well, that, you know, that headline stunned me. It said, oh, organic farming slams the head on industrial because they have more kinds of pests.
Well, on the subject of organic versus inorganic pesticides. The point that we were trying to get across, though, is that by being organic does not necessarily make you better.
Perhaps doesn't necessarily make you worse.
Sure.
Something I wish I could convince my grandmother of, who spends a lot of money buying things only if they say the word organic on the side. And often this doesn't really provide much of an advantage.
No. I mean, I'm sure you could pesticide your field with acid. It would destroy your crops. I mean, it probably would kill all the pests. But again, I think the point being is that the perception out there is that an organic pesticide is better for the environment, it's better for your crops, it's more effective, blah, 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 when it turns out it is in fact not. And that's the takeaway point. And I assume that Don just must have misheard us.
I must have.
Yeah, because we can't be wrong.
And if you think you misheard any of us, you can listen to that show in the archives on RadioFreeThinker.com. While I was away, I was still keeping up with local events, and I have a little highlight to share with you. Science World, as you know, is holding a consultation with the public about renovations. And one of the things that they're doing is taking over a bit of the outside space near Science World, the big dome. And they're going to turn it into a public park, an outdoor space with free exhibits and interactive learning things about environmentalism and various aspects of science and the outdoors. And they're asking the public about what they think about where they should do it and how they should do it. So you can go to Science World tonight, right after the show, as it's airing right now, and talk with them in person. You can also go tomorrow. Or you can go online to their website and fill out a little questionnaire survey about what you think about what they're doing. And another little highlight, I went to the IGA today, and apparently while I was away, the HST went into effect. So that was a bit of a shock. And they were handing out little flyers entitled Facts About the HST. And I thought this was interesting. Here's pretty much all it says on here. Facts about the HST. How it works. On July 1st, the provincial sales tax, PST, will be eliminated. On that date, you'll see the 7% BC rate join the 5% goods and services tax, GST, to give us a total HST rate of 12%. Questions? Visit the website, contact by phone. That's it. That's all it says about that. And as you've heard...
I already knew that!
You've heard on our show, there's quite a lot more to it than that. But we're not going to get into it again.
Actually, no. I was going to commend them. Because actually, they did... from what I remember, that was really the only facts that were there. There was a lot of, you know, inference. There was a lot of things you could draw out of data. But as far as black and white,
look at the link they provide. That is the longest link I've ever seen.
It's pretty obscure.
No one's going to type that in. That's like 18 letters.
Just so you guys know, it's hst.blog.gov.bc.ca/wp-content/ upload slash 2010 slash 05 slash GST underscore PSD underscore HST slash list slash VO4.PD. And it's not even a website. It's a PDF file.
did you get that down? You want us to repeat it? So you can actually, it's a testament to how jet lagged I was that I actually tried clicking on it with my thumb.
And don't worry. I heard just today that they're calling out the big guns. They're calling it unconstitutional. Whenever they cut, that's like saying Hitler. This is related to Hitler. It's kind of whenever they say a tax is unconstitutional, they've pulled a Clinton.
Well, we're right out of time, so we really have to go. And please don't make us talk about HSC some more. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening.
Are you a UBC student taking first year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up.